Morning, everyone. Again, my name is Matt. It's great to have so many people with us this morning. We've been in a series on Exodus, and we're working through the book. Today we're going to be in chapter 13, just to give you a little bit of a heads up. But Robert Burns, he has a poem, and the poem is actually not as famous as a single line from it, and I'm sure you'll recognize it. It's this: "The best laid plans of mice and men often go awry." And it's a claim that says it doesn't matter where you stand, you know, in the world, whether you're the most powerful, you're at the top of the food chain, you're a human being, or you're kind of at the bottom of the food chain, you're a mouse. That even the best of plans, you don't have the power to make happen all the time. That sometimes things are going to be out of your control, and as a result, your plans are not going to be able to go through. Again, that's whether you're a mouse or whether you're a human being. And it's a claim that I would 100% agree with. I think it's 100% true. It's true for us. It's true for people on this earth. But one person or one being who it's not true is for our God. Our God can make any plan he wants. There is no plan B with our God. He plans, and his plans always come to action. They will never be thwarted. And we've seen that in the Exodus account so far. And we're going to see that again today. So if you'll open your Bibles and turn with me to Exodus chapter 13, we'll start in verse 17. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, "Lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt." But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. And the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here." And they moved on from Succoth and encamped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea in front of Baal Zephon. You shall encamp facing it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, 'They are wandering in the land, the wilderness has shut them in.' And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord." And they did so. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people. And they said, "What is this we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" So he made ready his chariot and took his army with him, and took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them encamped at the sea by Pi Hahiroth in front of Baal Zephon. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they greatly feared. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." And Moses said to the people, "Fear not, stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent." The Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen." Then the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was the cloud and the darkness, and it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And in the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of fire and of cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, and upon their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. And as the Egyptians fled into it, the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen. Of all the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea, not one of them remained. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, and the waters being a wall to them on their right and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel from that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians, so that the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. Again, so we get to the famous crossing of the Red Sea. But before we even get to the crossing of the Red Sea, we see that God has a plan. That God has a plan regarding the navigation, that God has a plan regarding his presence, and finally, that God has a plan regarding deliverance. So let's first look at God's gracious plan of navigation. Now, as we're reading through there, you probably heard me read quite a few places, right? There are a bunch of locations. Locations, locations, locations are mentioned here. In this passage, we have Succoth, Baal-Zephon, Pi-Hahiroth, Migdol, Etham, the Philistine territory, the wilderness. We see so many different territories in this passage. And admittedly, scholars don't really know where these places are. The sands have changed quite a bit in the Middle East, so no one's really sure exactly where they were going. No one can chart the route out. They make educated guesses, but we're not sure exactly where all these places are. But there are a couple things to know about these places. First of all, it seems they could have gone somewhere else, right? If we look back to chapter 13, verses 17 and 18, this is what it says. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, "Lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt." So it seems that wherever these places are, the quickest route would have been the land of the Philistines. And that would have been the pragmatic choice. That would have been the effective choice, right? If you're short on time, you want to get there, you want to do the interstate route, that's the way to go. But God does not send them there. Why does God not send them there and rather chooses to send them on the way of the wilderness? Because it was gracious. God, in his grace, had determined that the people, if they would see war, which they certainly would have seen war, they would have seen battle had they gone the way of the Philistines, they would have turned back. They wouldn't have been ready to encounter, even though God does the fighting, as we're going to see here in this passage, they wouldn't have even been able to stand firm and let God do the fighting for them had they gone that way. So God, in his grace, chooses to, more so than pragmatism, more so than effectiveness, chooses the better path for them. And this isn't necessarily something that, should catch us off guard. We're like, no, they would have done okay. Because in Numbers, right, when Moses sends the spies into the land of Canaan, where do they come back? They say, yeah, the land is great, right? The land's great. But they say, oh, the people there, they're too big. They're too strong for us. Only Joshua and Caleb are the only two that say, no, we can go, we can do this, we can do this because God is with us. But the rest of them want to turn back. They don't want to enter the land that God had given them. So clearly, this was a problem that they would have encountered. But God chooses the alternative route. He chooses it in his grace, even though it's longer, because that's what the people needed at the time. Finally, regarding the navigation, regarding God's plan regarding the navigation, it's a meandering route. Although we don't know where it is, we see that they're turning one way, they're turning another way, they're going back to the point where the Egyptians think they're lost. They are wandering around in the desert. Let's go get them, right? But it is in God's purpose. And yes, it is trickery, but if we look at chapter 14, verses 1, 2, and 3, then the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pi-Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea. In front of Baal-Zephon, you shall encamp facing it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, 'They are wandering in the land, the wilderness has shut them in.'" Okay, so they're wandering around. They appear to be lost to the outsider, But God is purposely doing this in his gracious plan of navigation because it is tricking the Egyptians into God's plan. They look completely vulnerable, but yet that is God's design plan, exactly where he wants them. Even though we don't know exactly where that was, we know that it was exactly where God wanted them. God had a gracious plan regarding the navigation of his people. Secondly, God's gracious plan of presence. God had a gracious plan of his presence. That although, you know, they didn't have a GPS leading them around, they had God himself who was leading them around. First of all, we see God's presence in the pillars in chapter 13, verses 20 and 21. And they moved on from Succoth and encamped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people. So God just chooses to make his presence manifest in these pillars of clouds and fire. And so first and foremost, it was to lead the people, right? To lead this people on this crazy navigation route throughout the desert. That was the first and foremost point of God's presence and manifesting himself in the cloud and fire. But there's also many other functions for the cloud and fire. First of all, if we look in Psalm 108, I believe, it talks about that the cloud actually shaded the people. So if you're out and you're walking in the Middle East in the desert where, you know, temperatures reach 120 degrees in the shade, you probably want some shade, right? You're probably thinking, yes, I'll take 120 degrees today rather than, you know, I don't know, maybe 140 degrees. You want the cloud. You want the shade. It provides shade. But in desert territories, not only does it get extremely hot during the day, it can get rather cold at night. Thus the fire. So it provides warmth, it provides light, it provides direction, it provides protection. It would provide protection from the people, not only from these other armies that we see, but surely from people, from perhaps wild animals. God provided protection, he provided direction, and he provided identification. If you turn over to Exodus chapter 33, this is why Moses says, God, we can't do this without your presence. Exodus 33, verses 15 and 16. And he said to him, if your presence will not go with me, do not bring us up from here. For how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not in your going with us so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth? God had used this to identify that these are his people, he is their God, by the pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire, and it provides comfort too. Because Moses says, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it because people won't know that I'm your leader. People won't know that we're your people, and we need your security. We need your comfort, which indeed the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire provided the people. Secondly, we see God's presence in the angel of God. Chapter 14, verse 19, where the angel shows up. Then the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. Now, the angel of God, we've already seen this in Exodus at the burning bush. We're not necessarily going to hold to a 100% surety of this, but we think that the angel of God is in fact Jesus pre-incarnate in the Old Testament. That this is God himself, because it always throws them out interchangeably. The angel, God, and the angel of God. It uses them in the very same sentence, attributing both characteristics to them. So it seems to be that this is pre-incarnate Jesus. It's probably one and the same with the pillar too, that the angel of God is in fact the pillar. But it's another way of expressing that God is indeed present with his people. Lastly, although God is present with his people in the pillars and as the angel of God, God chooses to use a mediator. God chooses to use mediators that we see two times in this passage. We see two different mediators. And the reason being, although it's not listed explicitly in this passage, is it was actually in Exodus 33 where we read there, is that a holy God, people cannot stand in the presence of a holy God. Sinful people cannot stand in the presence of a holy God. And so he chooses to use mediators. The first mediator we actually see is Joseph, back in chapter 13, verse 19. And this is what he said. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here. Again, Joseph was one of the patriarchs. He was one of God's mediators to his people. And he was, in fact, the first mediator that we would have seen in the land of Egypt. He, after all, was the one who attracted God's people to come down to Egypt. So Joseph himself was a mediator between God and God's people. But then we, of course, see that Moses is God's mediator as well. Moses is God's mediator between the people speak to Moses, and then Moses speaks to God, and God speaks to Moses on trying to get his message to the people. First, look down at chapter 14, verses 10 through 12. This is what how it reads there. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they greatly feared. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. Okay, so it says they cried out to the Lord, but then notice, who do they actually talk to? Verse 11, they said to Moses, is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? So they start complaining to Moses. Even though they are crying out to the Lord, they're actually talking to Moses, and they're talking to God through Moses. And God does the exact same thing with Moses, because look in chapter 14, verse 15, this is what he says, the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Now, we just read that it was, in fact, the people that were crying to God, not Moses. But God uses you singular there. It's very specific that you singular there. He's saying, the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Why? Because Moses is God's mediator on behalf of the people, representing the people before God. God, in his gracious plan of presence, although he is clearly present with the people in the pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire, the angel of God, he still chooses to use a mediator. And in this case, that mediator is Moses. Lastly, we get to God's gracious plan of deliverance. Now the navigation, the plans of the navigation, the plans of presence are now coming to a head in the deliverance. But first, before we even get to that, let's talk about the purpose. Why is God even creating these plans? What is God's purpose in this? Because again, we started off by reading Robert Burns' quote, right? The best laid plans of mice and men often go awry. So what is the purpose? Although we might have a purpose in our plans, sometimes they go awry, but God's purpose will not go awry, as we will see. The purpose is that God himself, that Yahweh might be glorified and that he might be renowned. Look down in chapter 14, verse 4. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. That was said in regard to the navigation. Why is he choosing this meandering route? Because this is going to be the purpose, that he will be glorified over Pharaoh, over his people, and that he will be renowned. God repeats this again in chapter 14, verse 17 and 18. He says, and I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen. Again, that this is God's purpose in his plans, which he does, in fact, achieve. He achieves it two places. First, we see in verses 24 and 25, he achieves it there by this is how it reads. And in the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of fire and of cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. God achieves his purpose. The Egyptians recognize Yahweh is fighting for his people. They recognize that this is, in fact, God, the God who brought them out of Egypt, and he's leading them around the wilderness. Perhaps they thought maybe that God left them is why they were choosing that crazy route, because that was a very common thought in the ancient Near East, that God would be with people for a time but then leave them. But they recognize, no, that God is still there, that God is Yahweh, and he is getting glory over us. Now, how do we know? Because it doesn't really say he is getting glory over us. Well, in that passage there, when it says that he was clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily, that word heavily there is that same glory. God is getting glory over the chariots, which the Egyptian army had a fantastic, fantastic chariot force. It was renowned throughout the ancient Near East. And so in those chariots, God is getting glory over those chariots by making them heavy, which is the same word for glory, that he's glorying himself over the chariots, so much so that the people recognize that God is, in fact, acting here, and they are recognizing that whether they turn to God with their hearts or not, we don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us that. But they do at least recognize that God is renowned, that he is fighting for his people. And then in verse 30 and 31, thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore, that in fact God brought his purpose about. His purpose was achieved. It was combined with the navigation, and it was combined with the presence. Now, we talked a little bit in the navigation about how even though we don't know where they were going, that they were wandering around, they were in a vulnerable position. Wherever they were cornered on the sea, right by the sea. The Egyptians were coming down. They had them in a prime spot, but God had them exactly where he wanted them. I don't know if you've seen the movie The Princess Bride. You know that it's a great movie, and there's so many great lines in it. But when the man in black is fighting Inigo, right? They're doing this sword fight, and they're both very good fighters. And at some point, the man he's fighting, he smiles and he says, "You know, I know something you don't." And he says, "What's that?" He says, "I'm not left-handed." So this whole time he's been fighting him left hand, because theoretically his left hand's not quite as good as his right hand. So he's tricking him into thinking, "I'm a little bit vulnerable, but now I go to my right hand." And then the man in black comes back, you know, just a minute later and says, I should tell you something in that case. I'm not left-handed either." And so although they both appeared vulnerable at some point in time, they in fact were doing it as a deceitful move to win the battle. And in fact, this is what God is doing. He has positioned them straight by the sea, which looks like an extremely vulnerable position as they're cornered. But that is the very spot that God wanted them. Because again, people in the ancient Near East, they weren't swimmers, right? Even the sport, the Olympic sport of swimming, didn't come about until 1896. And you know that the British Army didn't even start, or the British Navy, sorry, didn't even start training their sailors how to swim until the early 20th century. So swimming is a very modern phenomenon. People would not really have known how to swim, certainly not everyone. And with all their stuff that they were bringing, right, all the stuff that they had plundered the Egyptians with, they certainly couldn't have gotten away. They looked like they were in a terrible spot, but it was the very spot that God wanted them to be, right along the sea, so that he could display his power and that he might get glory over the Egyptians and he might get renown for who he is. Now, again, the other way that God is carrying about his plan of deliverance is through his presence. Because we talked about the presence offered protection. It offered a barrier for the proper timing that they needed. It delayed the Egyptians and it confused them. If you look down in verses 19 and 20, "Then the angel of God who was going before the host of Israel moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was the cloud in the darkness, and it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night." So again, even God's presence is playing a role here in the deliverance. That God has a plan, and he is using both the navigation and the presence to achieve his plan, which ultimately is to deliver his people through the Red Sea on dry land. And it specifically mentions that dry land twice, that they're going through, and they're going through on dry land. Two times, verses 22 and 29. It also mentions in those very verses that there was a wall of water on their left and a wall of water on their right. Now, modern scientists, they want to know, you know, is this really possible, right? Because they want to explain God in natural terms. But God is a supernatural being. Although they are actually have witnessed, physicists understand that there's this kind of wind downset effect, because the wind comes in and it starts to blow. And they've actually witnessed that wind can, in fact, create a wall of water on the left and the right. But it's a very small wind, and if anything provides a barrier to that wind, the water will obviously come back. So something very supernatural is going on here, because even what they've witnessed is a rather small path of water. But we read that there's a wall of water on the left and a wall of water on the right. Now, that word wall, there are different words for wall in Hebrew, but this word wall is always referred to as a city wall. And city walls were at a minimum always at least 20 feet high. So we're not talking like, oh, they kind of waded through on a sandbar or something like that that people want to explain. No, this is a gigantic wall, at least a 20-foot wall on their left and on their right, which probably would have, in fact, terrified many of the Israelites to walk through. But they did. They did because God had commanded. They knew by the grace of his presence as he was leading them through that ultimately he was going to get them through. And then the Egyptians had to have been terrified themselves to go through this, because they're like, what possibly could happen? That the water could come crashing down on them at any second. But Pharaoh commanded, their hearts were hardened, and they figured, hey, if the Israelites can do it, we, the mighty Egyptians, should be able to do it too. But that's not, in fact, what happens. That ultimately the wind ceases, and the wind there, right, is the spirit or the ruah. So even the spirit of God, we see the Trinity as at work here in the angel of God, the Lord, and the spirit or the wind that is blowing over the waters, just as it was in creation in Genesis 1. The spirit was hovering over the waters. That we see that our triune God is at work in delivering the people, and it's ultimately so that they were free. So the people got to go free. In verses 28 and 29, we see that Moses writes, "The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen. Of all the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea, not one of them remained. But God's people, the people of Israel, walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on their right and on their left." God had a plan of deliverance, and he accomplished it. But God is more than a planner. His plan has gone back quite far. His plan has gone back quite far. Let's look back to chapter 13, where Joseph is mentioned in verse 19. "Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, 'God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here.'" Okay, that quote actually comes from Genesis 50, where Joseph does, in fact, speak and says, "Hey, God has a plan for you. We're getting out of this place," even though at the time of Joseph, the relationship between the Israelites and the Egyptians were quite good. He said, "This is not our home. God has a plan. He's bringing us to a place where he wants us to go." But we see that the plan goes back even farther than Joseph. It goes to his grandfather, Abraham, in Genesis 15. This is God's plan all the way back in Genesis 15. We read, "Then the Lord said to Abram," verse 13, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for yourself, you shall go to your fathers in peace, you shall be buried in a good old age, and they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." Now, I don't know how far ahead you make plans, but we see here that there are some major plans being made in advance of God. God has planned this at least, you know, that the Bible records, although surely before this, all the way back to Abraham. He had made his plans that this is what he was going to do. He was going to save his people by delivering them from the Egyptians, all the way back to Abraham. But God's more than a planner. He's not just a planner. God is a doer. And we see that because of the different roles that are played here in this passage. We see the roles of God, the roles of Moses, and the roles of the people. Now we look to verse 14 of chapter 14, and we see there, as I turn back, this is what Moses said that God's going to do. "The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent." And that doesn't mean a literal silence. That means, hey, you just need to kind of sit there. Follow God's lead. You just need to sit there and follow God's lead because the Lord is going to fight for you. So the people, they're not really doing anything other than following God's instruction. They're moving around wherever God tells them to go. That's where they go. They obey Moses, who is God's mediator, as they move around. And Moses is acting as God's mediator, right? He's stretching out his hand. He's stretching out his staff, which again is God's staff, signifying that he is, in fact, the mediator on God's behalf. But that's, again, that's all he's doing. He's waving his hand around, right? But what's God doing? This is the action that God is doing because God is a doer. The Lord hardens hearts in verse 8. He fights in verse 14. As Moses stretches out his hand in verse 16 and 17, this is the distinction that it makes between what Moses is doing and what God's doing. God says, "Lift up your staff out of your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground." And that "you" there is really emphatic. He's saying, hey, you're going to do this. But verse 17, this is what I'm going to do. And the "I" is emphasized. "And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his hosts." God's hardening hearts. He is getting glory. God is also the angel of God. Is doing the dividing of the two camps in verses 19 and 20. The Lord divides the waters by the Ruah, the Spirit, in verse 21. The Lord confuses the army and he messes with the wheels. He makes them drive heavily. He gets glory over their wheels in verses 24 and 25. And so much so that the Egyptians, in fact, attribute, they're saying, "Yahweh, the Lord, he is fighting for the people," in verse 25. The Lord, it says, sweeps the Egyptians into the sea in verse 27. Yahweh saves from the Egyptians' hands by his hand in verses 30 and 31. Let's go back and read that. "Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore." And then verse 31, if verse 31 were to read literally, although most of our English translations don't do it because it does sound odd, "Israel saw the great hand that the Lord used against the Egyptians. So the people feared the Lord. So it's comparing the hand of the Egyptians to the hand of God. God is more than a planner. God is a doer. He is delivering his people through the Red Sea from the hand of the Egyptians. And he is delivering them from the service and the enslavement of the Egyptians. Well, that's nice, but we see that this is not all the Bible has to say about the Exodus. This is not all the Bible has to say about the crossing of the Red Sea. In fact, this is constantly mentioned throughout the rest of the Bible, throughout the Psalms, and even in the New Testament, and yes, even with Jesus. Jesus has a connection to the Exodus. There's a tendency to over-spiritualize the Old Testament from time to time, but clearly this is not over-spiritualizing because Jesus himself picks up on this in the Transfiguration. In Luke chapter 9, verse 31, this is the very word that he uses as he's talking with Moses, another connection